I'd like to begin today with the first greeting, because it's a reading that had a great, or tells about something that had a great deal of effect on the Jewish people. It starts talking about this person, Cyrus. Now, Cyrus was a Persian king who lived in the 6th century before Christ. Cyrus had a different philosophy of how to run his empire. Rather than trying to oppress people, it was his philosophy to try to work with them, to honor their customs, their traditions, their religion. And so the kingdom he inherited had the Jewish people in it that had been exiled into Babylon, what is now Baghdad. And so he issued a decree saying that all of those of Jewish heritage could go back to their homeland. And he not only let them go home, but he also sent with them resources, money, wood, stone, to rebuild the temple and to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Now, this reading is saying to us that he was actually an instrument in the hands of God. And yet it focuses very much on the fact that he did not know God. He was a pagan. It says that twice in that reading, though he knew him not, it says. But what happened from that was that the Jewish people came to realize that their God is truly the God of all nations. Before that, there was a certain sense that, well, every nation has its God. Our God is this God, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, but those other nations have their own gods. But with what happened through Cyrus, and how Cyrus the unbeliever became an instrument in the hands of God, they realized that their God was the only God. And notice the reading says that twice. That their God could control the destiny of all peoples. And he can make anyone an instrument in his hands. That was a great awareness for the Jewish people. But now I want to go from that to the gospel reading. The gospel reading also deals with a political ruler, Caesar. But this time we have the question, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? Now, that was a burning question at the time of Jesus, because people resented very much having to pay taxes to a foreign power. But there was another group, the Herodians, who believed that you should try to appease the foreign power so that you could live at peace. And so they were in favor of paying the taxes. The Pharisees and a vast majority of the people bitterly resented it. And the question was posed to Jesus to put him in a predicament. If he says, pay the taxes, the Pharisees thought that the people would turn against him, that they would hate him. If he says, don't pay the taxes, then they thought that the Roman authorities would come down upon him as trying to start a rebellion. And so they hoped to catch him in that trap. Now, what does it say to us? Because we're not there. Well, it does say to us that we too have to pay tribute to our political leaders, and that it is not wrong to support them. It is not wrong to pay taxes to them. In fact, it's very necessary for us to do that. And yet, if we look deeper into the story, there's another message. Take that image on the coin. What did Jesus say? Whose image is it? And they said, Caesar. And then he said, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Now, go back into the biblical story, way back to the beginning. What does it say about us and whose image is imprinted on us? Does not the book of Genesis teach us that we were created in the image of God? And so that, like that coin was imprinted with the image of Caesar and therefore belonged to Caesar, we have been imprinted with the image of God. And therefore, we belong to God. And even Caesar, although we must honor him and respect him and support him, whoever that Caesar is among us, he too is created in the image of God. And so that ultimately, all of us must give answer to God. And whatever the political powers do that are contrary to God, we should not support. But whatever we can do with morally good conscience, we need to support. But it says even something deeper, that all of us owe everything we are and everything we have to God. We have been created in His image. And it is our duty, our obligation, to return to God our very lives, our very selves, because we have been imprinted with His divine image. Now, in the context of what we've been doing in the last few weeks, I'd like to speak about that in relationship to the Mass. You know, we come to the offertory of the Mass, and we bring up bread and wine. We bring up the collection that has been gathered. Those are meant to be symbols of ourselves. Notice the wording that is used over the bread. The work of human hands. Yes, God provides them. We labor over them. We present them to God. The same with the collection we bring up. It symbolizes the labor we do and the payment for our labor. So in a sense, it symbolizes ourselves. All that we bring up, we offer to God as symbolic of the very gift of ourselves. And there at that offertory time, we take that bread and wine, we offer it to the Father, and we ask Him to accept that little meager sacrifice that we're giving Him. But we do that knowing that whatever we offer to God, God can take and transform and make it into something wonderful, something great. So He takes that little bread, that little wine, that really is almost nothing, and He transforms that into the very life of Jesus, His Son. And of course, the purpose of all that is to transform you and I. We are to be transformed through the Eucharist into the image of Jesus Christ. And we are to become, in a very real sense, the presence of Jesus Christ here on the earth. If you take this little sheet, and please take these home with you. I'm about halfway down on the first inside page. It speaks about in the Latin rite of the Catholic Church. That's the rite that we are. And matter of fact, most of Western Europe, most of the Americas are in the Latin rite. There are some Eastern rites among us, not very many. And especially in this part of Kansas, you'd be hard-pressed to find one. But there are groups in the Catholic Church united to Rome, but have very different ways of worshiping. They have Mass, but their Mass is very, very different. But in our rite, we always use unleavened bread. It's made with flour and water, nothing else, nothing to make it raise. And it's a symbolic thing for us. Like the ancient Jews who were in journey from Egypt into the Promised Land, we too are on a journey. We're on a journey to the kingdom of heaven. It expresses our deep inner poverty, that we have no permanent dwelling place here, but that our final dwelling place is meant to be the kingdom of heaven. We put water into the wine, and the reason for that is that it is probable that when Jesus was at the Last Supper, he used wine that had been diluted with water. It was the custom of the Jews to do that. Why exactly? We're not sure. Maybe it was to purify their water. Maybe it was because if they drank too much wine at full strength, they had another problem. We're not sure. But that was the custom. And so it is assumed that that's what Jesus did at the Last Supper. But the churches began to understand that as a mingling of the divine and the human. That through the Eucharist, the divinity is mixed with our humanity, and we are to be transformed. Let's go on to the next page, the washing of the hands. Now, that probably had its origin in the Mass as a very practical thing. You know, because people didn't just bring up money at the offertory or just bread and wine. They brought up eggs and cream and milk and chickens and all sorts of things as an offering to the church in those ancient days. Well, the priest received that, and it's probable that he needed to wash his hands. And so that gradually became part of the liturgy. But again, it was transformed into a very symbolic gesture. The realization of the priest that he was a sinner and that he needed to be purified. He needed forgiveness to enter into the celebration of the Eucharist. As the priest washes his hands in the new rite, it's a slight change from what we do now, he will say, "Wash me, O Lord, from my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sins." He says this silently. After that, he invites the people to pray that our gifts, the gifts of bread and wine, the gift of the offering of ourselves, that all of that will be acceptable to God, the Almighty Father. And then there's a prescribed prayer for each Sunday that he will say. Let's go now to the Eucharistic prayer. Now, the word Eucharist in itself means thanksgiving. And so that begins our great prayer of thanksgiving. And it begins with a dialogue. The Lord be with you. And like at the beginning of Mass, everyone will respond in the new liturgy and with your spirit. Then the priest invites everyone to lift up their hearts. In other words, direct your hearts upward to become part of the worship of the angels and saints in heaven. That what we do here somehow gets united with their great act of worship. And then there'll be a slight change in the dialogue where the priest will say, "Let us give thanks to the Lord our God." And instead of saying, "It is right to give him thanks and praise," you'll simply say, "It is right and just." Now, the preface prayer varies according to seasons and times. We're now in ordinary time. We have about 8 options we can choose from. We'll be moving into Advent. We'll have options for Advent. We have options for Lent. We have options for Easter. We have options for feasts of various saints. All of those are dependent on the dates and the seasons. We have a couple Eucharistic prayers, number 4, and then some of the Eucharistic prayers for reconciliation that have their own proper preface. And when we, and in those seasons like Lent or Easter, we usually don't use those prayers because the preface prayer is proper to that Eucharistic prayer. Okay, let's go to the Holy Holy on backside. I want to bring out in here that this is a very ancient prayer of the church. Already in the year 96, or around that time, in the writings of Pope Clement I, we have a reference to the Holy Holy. So it comes out of that distant past. And we say holy, holy, holy because the Hebrew people had no way of expressing the superlative, the most holy. The way they did that was that triple repetition. And the church has kept that expression, that there is nothing holier than God. Hosts, in the new translation, we will say the heavenly hosts, and that refers to the army of heaven, the army of the angels. It comes from a Hebrew word, Sabaoth, meaning army. We used it to express the majesty of God. Now, at the end of the Holy Holy, we have the phrase, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, that comes out of Mark's gospel. When Jesus is entering into Jerusalem, the people are saying, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. The Holy 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 part came from Isaiah's writing, chapter 6, verse 3. And what I want to stress in that is simply, these prayers that we use our Mass are very scripturally inspired. And they come from prayer that is imbued with the Scriptures. And that's partially why we're having the changes. Because somehow in the translation that we've used, some of that imagery of Scripture was lost. And the church wants us to get back to that. And so these changes are coming to bring out more richly those scriptural images. I would just again like to ask you to take these home, read them. They try to give us a little bit of an understanding of what the Mass is all about. The changes in the Mass at this part are basically pretty minimal for you. They're going to be greater for the celebrant. But what I really want is not to focus on the changes. I want to focus on why we're here, what it means that we're doing, so that we can come to Mass to understand the Mass more fully, to enter into it with the totality of our being.